I'm going to talk about liturgies of conversion in the early Middle Ages, and I'm going to use examples from Carolingian Francia and Ottonian Germany mainly, and I'm going to end with a little excursion to a territory where I'm more comfortable, which is central medieval Scandinavia. Christianization is a broad cultural and social phenomenon. Studying it forces us to reconsider simple, stable categories of religious affiliation, and to think instead of the fuzzy edges of religious difference and of volatile, changeable societies where you can no longer recourse to tradition and where the old customs are losing their meaning. And in the end, Christianization, even as a social and cultural phenomenon, comes down to individual conversions. These might well be quiet, smooth occasions, superficial transitions from the formal profession of one faith to another, with little effect on the inner life of the convert. As often as not, however, we can expect also early medieval conversions to have had dramatic effects on the individual, to have been experienced as a radical change from one basic mindset to another, effectively as the assumption of a new identity. Certainly, this had been the case in the paradigmatic conversions in Christianity, that of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, and that of Augustine in the garden in Milan in 386. In the early Middle Ages, first-person narratives of this kind are few and far between, and in early medieval Northern Europe, the personal experience of conversion to Christianity is particularly elusive. What we have instead are either second-hand narrative accounts of conversions by Christian authors, or theoretical, normative, and prescriptive texts about how a conversion to Christianity should proceed. Such texts inevitably say more about the formal aspects of conversion than they do about internal personal change. That does not mean, however, that they say nothing about the reality of conversion. A clear distinction between the internal and internal aspects of religious experience is often impossible in practice anyway. A change of behavior becomes a change of mind. Furthermore, the protocols of religious rituals, even if ineffective, aimed at instilling a certain response in both the participants and the audience. They conveyed a certain aesthetic, and that aesthetic was not arbitrary. In this paper, I shall examine early medieval liturgies of conversion using both prescriptive and narrative sources. I shall begin with a seemingly self-evident truth. The liturgy of conversion is the liturgy of baptism. This can be reversed. The liturgy of baptism is always also a liturgy of conversion, at least when the ceremony is taken as a whole. Baptismal formulas bring the candidate from the darkness of ignorance into the presence of God. They begin with an exorcism, proceed through a renunciation of Satan, and remain anti-demonic throughout. In this sense, the state of the unbaptized is analogous to that of the pagan. They continue with a didactic element, a scrutiny, analogous to the basic instruction and preaching which would have been part of the conversion process in a missionary situation. The candidates are interrogated on the central elements of the Christian faith, usually the creed, the gospel, and the Lord's Prayer. During the scrutiny, the candidates are called catechumens, under instruction. The catechumenate, as a body of people and as a stage in Christian life, was a remnant from ancient Christianity. Being a catechumen had different implications in the early church, in which adult baptism was widespread and people could remain catechumens for years. By the early Middle Ages, when infant baptism was the norm, the scrutiny was largely formal and conducted between the priest and the baptismal sponsors who stood in for the candidates. At the end of the process, the candidates are baptized at a font and clad in white. External change mirrors internal transformation and the emergence of a new member of the church. This describes only the roughest outlines of how baptism was supposed to proceed. It needs to be stressed here at the very beginning of the paper that there was no such thing as the baptismal liturgy in the early medieval West. Formulas varied between regions and between different types of churches. In the simplest of schemes, they varied from a maximalist rite at the one end, usually called Roman in the literature, to a small-scale rite at the other, with only one priest involved. The Roman rite for baptism is found at its fullest in the so-called Gelasian Sacramentary from the mid-7th century and in the Ordo Romanus number 11, as edited by Michel Andrieux. Does everyone have a handout? By the way? That's good. Yeah. The relationship between these texts is complicated and much debated. In most manuscript witnesses, they have been supplanted with texts of Frankish origin. The rite is distinguished by its elaborateness and communal nature. It's written for an Episcopal church and for the presence of several clergy. Baptism is a seasonal event. The candidates are presumed to be infants. They are first brought to church by their sponsors on the Wednesday of the third week in Lent, where a priest makes the sign of the cross on their foreheads and exorcises them, signifying their entry into the catechumenate. The candidates remain catechumens for the following several weeks, which are punctuated by a number of formal scrutiny masses. The actual baptism happens in Holy Week as part of the Easter Vigil and is followed immediately by confirmation by the bishop. At the other end of the scale, we have a much less ambitious rite. It could be performed on a single occasion, by a single priest, and at any time of the year. Confirmation by the bishop was deferred to a later occasion, often expected to be several years later. The scrutiny was not codified and would have been performed in the vernacular, and the period of catechism very short indeed. Such a rite was particularly suitable in rural areas or if the candidate was ill. Between these extremes, we have a number of variants and compromises and local peculiarities. And of course, these are only textual variants. In practice, baptism would have proceeded in all sorts of different ways. This, however, is not to say that ecclesiastical authorities took a laissez-faire approach to baptismal practice. In fact, in Carolingian Francia, baptism was one of the subjects that most exercised the clergy. The modern literature on the subject is correspondingly extensive, but I must single out for mention the late Susan Keefe's two-volume book, The Water and the Word. Keefe gathered together, edited and analysed all surviving Carolingian baptismal tracts, amounting to a full 61 texts found in hundreds of manuscripts. Many of these take their starting point in the inquiry into the proper practice of baptism sent out to the Frankish metropolitan bishops by Charlemagne in around 812. Charlemagne certainly took a strong personal interest in baptism. His concerns seem to have been primarily with clerical and episcopal training and with pastoral care, not directly with conversion and missionary activity. In the end, however, such concerns do inform many of the Carolingian baptismal tracts. Many of the respondents to Charlemagne's inquiry made use of a short text from a few years earlier, probably written by Alcuin, or at least known to be representative of Alcuin's theology of baptism. The text is a brief description and explication of a small-scale baptismal ceremony, and the candidate is an adult convert from paganism. Primo paganus, it begins. Alcuin's doubts about the efficacy of forced baptism in the wake of the conquest of Saxony are well known. Elsewhere, baptismal treatises are found in manuscripts together with texts that are clearly intended for a missionary situation, and some texts make it clear that the candidate may be an adult. But for all that most of the evidence for Carolingian worries about conversion and baptism are texts about baptism rather than baptismal formulas or baptismal ordinances as such, there is a very interesting exception. This is a set of prayers called Ordo ad Catechumenum ex Pagana Faciendum, the rite for making a catechumen out of a pagan, first found in the Gelasian Sacramentary and in the same form in three of the so-called mixed or 8th century Gelasians. As the title implies, it contains only texts relating to the first part of the baptismal process. In this form, the Ordo is very basic indeed and consists of only three proper prayers. It is one of a series of simplified baptismal formulas appended to the elaborate Gelasian rite which I described above for emergency or reduced circumstances. It continued being copied also later and occurs in at least one of the long series of mixed Gregorian Gelasian sacramentaries produced in Ottonian Fulda. A more elaborate form of the same Ordo also appears in a number of collections of pontifical liturgy from Ottonian Germany in the so-called Romano-Germanic pontifical tradition, where it's followed by a full baptismal Ordo, slightly modified, presumably in anticipation of rudimentary material conditions. The Ordo does not appear in related collections after the 11th century, but then the trend in generally for baptismal rites is to disappear from mass books and from pontifical manuscripts in the central Middle Ages and occur in priests' manuals instead. So it might be possible to trace the Ordo into a later period, but it's not something I've had an opportunity to do for this paper. The Gelasian text of the conversion Ordo is on your handout under number 1. In the Romano-Germanic Pontifical, the same three proper prayers are in the same place, but the instructions surrounding them are rather more detailed. With very minor adjustments, these instructions follow the formula for emergency baptism of the sick. There are a few things to note about the proper prayers themselves. and the way in which they differ from the equivalent ceremony when intended for a Christian infant. First, in the first prayer, note the centrality of the sign of the cross on the forehead of the candidate after the exsufflation, which I'll come back to later. Second, that the second prayer asks of God to, I quote, command that this thy servant who now wanders uncertain and doubtful in the darkness of this world be shown the way of truth and of the knowledge of thee, that the eyes of his heart being opened he might acknowledge that thou art one God, the Father in the Son and the Son in the Father, and receive the fruit of this confession both here and in the world to come. Can we see traces of anti-Arian argumentation here? Certainly the formula seems to anticipate some of the knottier aspects of doctrinal explanation which could face a minister blessing an inquisitive candidate. The third prayer, which follows the distribution of salt to the candidate, differs from the equivalent text in the order for the sick, literally in mood. The conversion order has a tentative subjunctive. May he come to the fount of the laver, so that being reborn by water and the Holy Spirit, he may strip off the old man and put on the new. In the order for an infant, there's little need to strip off the old man, and the mood is a resolute imperative. Lord, lead him to the labour of the second birth, it ends. This difference may be significant, and I'll come back to it later. Susan Keefe could show that most of the Carolingian baptismal tracts related to a specific ordo, sometimes possible to identify. In one case, in a section of baptism in Rabanus Maurus's De Institutione Clericorum, the text appears to be based almost exactly on the conversion ordo as later found in the Romano Germanic Pontifical. It could be that Rabanus Maurus had a missionary situation in mind, but it's important to note that many of the other tracts anticipate that the minister will be following a reduced baptismal ordo, whether for a pagan or for the sick, even when the candidate was a healthy infant. This was simply the most practical way of administering baptism, in particular in the countryside. In a missionary situation, far from large churches and in difficult circumstances, the option of a quick and simplified baptismal ceremony would have been essential. In other cases, however, conversion baptisms required the very opposite of a short, simplified rite. One example comes from the acts of the Episcopal Council gathered by Charlemagne's son Pippin in 796, after the conquest of the Avars. The bishop concluded that as rough a people as the Avars could not be expected to become proper Christians after a summary baptismal ceremony and a short formalized instruction. Biblical precedents were inadequate models, as they usually concerned Jewish converts, who would already have some idea of the rudiments of the faith. Instead, the bishop stressed the importance of carrying out baptism at the legitimate time, that is, at Easter and at Pentecost, in cases where candidates were neither ill nor infants. They stipulated at least 7, but preferably up to 40 days of teaching the candidates the Christian faith with daily catechisms. This document shows how conscious the Carolingian ecclesiastical authorities were of how baptismal rites could be adapted to suit a particular situation, and how a self-conscious return to an earlier practice was very much an option. If such rites actually took place, if the necessary resources were available, they would presumably have been very public events, and perhaps confined to the elite. Certainly, grand baptismal ceremonies were part of the Carolingian political repertoire. One of the most well-known is the baptism of the Danish king Harald Clack and of his wife and his retainers at the court of Louis the Pious in 826, described in some detail by Ermoldus Michelus. Ermoldus wrote the episode into a sacral historical context and made Harald's baptism a microcosm of salvational history. Louis stood as Harald's sponsor at the ceremony, and Harald, in addition to becoming his godson, also swore him fidelity and handed himself over as his man. Such relations were probably reproduced elsewhere, also at other social levels. Baptismal sponsorship and godparenthood was one of the ways in which Christianity could be integrated into and indeed constitutive of a recently converted lay society. And then there's a peculiarity of conversion liturgy which will be my focus for the rest of this paper. This is the remarkable practice by which a pagan is made a catechumen but then not baptized. That is, the baptismal ceremony is interrupted at the precise moment where the ordo ad catechumenum ex pagano faciendum ends in the Gelasian Missal. This is called prime signing and has been a fairly prominent topic in the history of Viking Age Scandinavia. Its name comes from the Latin prima signatio, the first sign of the cross made on the candidate by the celebrant, so prominent in the first prayer in the conversion order of your handout, on your handout. The word prime signing first occurs in French vernacular texts, where at times it refers simply to the first part of a complete baptismal ceremony, at times seemingly to a separate event. Prime signing is, however, relatively poorly attested in early medieval sources. The possibility of an extended catechumenate is, of course, implicit in the conversion ordinance, and the slightly uncertain subjunctive mood at the end could indicate that it left the possibility of an incomplete ceremony open. But the option is certainly not broached explicitly. Otherwise, the best evidence comes in Rimbert's Life of Ansgar, written in the second half of the 9th century. Rimbert wrote of the pagans north of the Elbe and said that they were often enthusiastic about Christianity and could readily be baptized. Many, however, preferred, and I quote, this is on your handout under number 2, signed with a cross in order to become catechumens, and that they might enter the church and be present at the sacred services. But they deferred the reception of baptism, as they judged that it was to their advantage to be baptized at the end of their life, so that, having been cleansed by water unto salvation, they might without any delay enter the gates of eternal life as those who were pure and spotless. It seems a reasonable explanation, and it certainly holds water theologically. And like the 796 instructions to the Abbars, it self-consciously harks back to earlier practice. This is the sort of argument that could be found in the Church Fathers, and particularly in Augustine, whose treatise on the Catechism of the Ignorant, the De Catechizandis Rubibus, was widely read in Carolingian Francia and used to explain the status of the catechumen. Catechumens, says Augustine, are like the Jews, to whom Jesus did not yet trust himself. If we ask a catechumen, "Do you believe in Christ?" he says, "I believe," and signs himself and does not blush at the cross. If we ask him, "Do you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood?" he doesn't know what we're saying, because Jesus has not yet trusted himself to him. The greater part of the literature will, however, give a rather different reason for why Scandinavian pagans preferred prime signing to baptism. This is based on Icelandic sagas, where prime signing occurs in numerous texts dating from the late 12th century onwards. The idea here is that pagan Scandinavians, travelling to the British Isles or the continent, were prime signed in order to do business with Christians. They never really intended to convert and would revert to the old religion once home. In effect, it's a Viking rite. One well-known instance comes from Egil's saga, and it's on your handout under number 3. King Athelstan of England asks two Icelandic brothers who have entered his service to take the sign of the cross, as was common custom then, both amongst merchants and amongst those who went into the service of Christian men, because those men who had been prime signed could associate with Christians as well as pagans, and could still believe in whichever faith that pleased them. This, it must be said, sounds very convincing indeed. Of course, a highly developed verisimilitude is one of the distinguishing features of the Icelandic kings and family sagas. Saga authors were realists avant la lettre, and they knew how to add the kind of details to their narratives that made them seem likely to have actually happened. We can see similar mechanisms at work in another, more successful type of conversion narrative found in the sagas. A missionary cleric is performing the liturgy, and a non-Christian bystander is at first sceptical, then impressed. He becomes curious about the new religion and is eventually persuaded to convert. This, of course, is also a type of conversion liturgy, the Christian rite which, by its beauty and splendour, so fascinates the pagan that he is convinced to convert. It could be the subject of another paper. But one example is the tale of Thorvaldur the Far-Travelled, in which Thorvaldur's father is impressed by the celebration of the office by a German missionary. The Christian ceremony, all these things, goes the tale, pleased him rather well, Helder Bill. This is on your handout under number 3. In Njal's saga, a chieftain, Hattel, is impressed by the celebration of the Mass of St. Michael by another German missionary, Thangbrand, and asks him to tell him about the saint. "He weighs everything you do," says Thangbrand, "both good and evil, and he's so merciful that he gives more weight to what is well done." Hattler answers, "I would like him to be my friend," and is baptized. There's a charming rusticity to both of these episodes, reminding us that humour could be as good a tool as any for impressing the memory of conversion on the audience. The comic stereotype of the ignorant Viking convert goes back a long time. We famously find him in Notker's Gesta Caroli, In an episode in which a large number of Vikings are baptized at the imperial court, one candidate complains about the insufficiently fine tunic he was clad in at the end. He had been baptized 20 times before, he says, and never received such an ugly shirt before. Notker makes it clear that this demonstrated the contempt shown by all Northmen to the Christian faith. In a way, he also seems to anticipate the more pragmatic explanation of prime signing found in the sagas. In the sagas, the reluctant convert is, however, presented much more sympathetically. Often, prime side Vikings end up converting eventually anyway. But from our point of view, the prime signing episodes in the sagas might well point above all to the weakness or superficiality of Viking conversions. But they also show how open a soldier or merchant from pagan Scandinavia could be to the Christian faith. They point to the importance of religious status and to an awareness of how seemingly rarefied distinctions between catechumens and Christians, which referred in most cases to an outdated practice from centuries before, could have had the most tangible impact on real lives. Similarly, Notker's story might at first seem to be almost flippant about the efficacy of baptism. But for all that this story was clearly intentionally humorous, there's a very serious point to it. You don't mess about with baptism. It points again to how religious ritual was not just unthinkingly performed, but discussed and contested. The complex discourse about baptism in Carolingian Francia was part of a sophisticated system of thinking about and practicing religious ritual. This system helped to conceptualize conversion, both for the priest and for the convert. It was also a means for the clergy to control the narratives of conversion and of controlling the experience of conversion. Such conversion narratives were fictions by necessity, as Chris Wickham reminded us yesterday, but they were also necessary fictions. And to conclude on a point about agency, Viking prime signing is, in some ways, for me at least, a heartening instance of how outsiders could interact with a Christian ritual system intelligently and to their own ends.